Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. And boy, we're going to be showing it to you in a way that maybe is going to be surprising. For those of you who are regular listeners to the show, you know there's two topics I typically don't bother with. That's politics and religion. Anything and everything else is fair game for discussion. My guest today, though, has an interesting background that has brought him in contact with top political figures throughout the country. And he's been a part of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. He's been associated with the Senate, the House of Representatives. I mean, this man has been around some pretty big political swingers, I'll say, and maybe that's not a nice word to use. But regardless, he has been on major shows talking about communication, but it's communication in a way that involves branding. It involves so many different levels. His book is called On Message, How a Compelling Narrative Will Make Your Organization Succeed. I want to welcome to the airwaves Zach Friend. Zach, hi.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on today.
Zach, you're a man that has got a very unique job, and it involves so many different levels of communication. How is it that you found yourself evolving into an arena that is, one, extremely controversial, but two, that you really have to be, if you're going to do a good job, you don't truly get involved in the politics. It is the business of communication, and a word that some people aren't going to like, fabrication. Am I right?
Well, I think that unfortunately too often people within the industry of political communication, even business communication, think that they can trick people or frame things or spin things. But honestly, what really works is just the world of communicating honesty and sincerity and transparency and some sense of genuineness. That's what actually resonates with people. And I think that people are not realizing that in the world of communications, and if you have your own business, you have your own nonprofit, or you're just trying to even communicate with your family, it doesn't do you any good to try and win the single media story by framing it in a way that's only convenient to you and ignores all the rest of the facts. Ultimately, you want to build a story, a narrative about yourself that is built on this trust, this sincerity, and this sense of genuineness that really will resonate in the long term.
I loved it how at the beginning of your book, you said it was easy to trust the bears. And those bears were very special bears. And it started when you were a small child. Who were the bears? And why was it important that you be able to trust those bears?
Well, the bears were the Berenstain Bears. My mom was a big reader to me when I was growing up. Both my parents are big readers, but my mom was big on reading children's books, and I just completely fell in love with the Berenstain Bears. It wasn't until I got older that I began to think about what those bears were actually, or Jan and Stan Berenstain and the authors, were trying to teach us. And what they were really teaching us dealt with very complex issues, homes moving, families even getting divorced, or difficulty at school, getting picked on at school. Significant life experiences for children, things with morals, things with, but they did it through a very easy to grasp story, and you began to feel like you were a part of their family. I mean, obviously they're not real, but as a 6-year-old you can't tell the difference, or a 3-year-old you can't tell the difference, and you became a part of that story. You trusted them. And so I saw that as a very similar basis to how, political figures or campaigns or businesses or nonprofits or whatever, how you actually can succeed and last is the same way, is to create these trusting stories, I mean, that are true. And that's the easiest and best part about this, and I think the best part about the book is this isn't teaching somebody how to lie or how to, you know, just quickly win a media story. It's mm-hmm. really just saying tap into who you really are and use that as the foundation then for explaining what you do?
I think a good example that recently just saddened, deeply saddened a lot of people was the Lance Armstrong scenario. Because there had been so much truth in what, using your words, in what he was portraying. He seemed to be right out there in front. He was right there sharing with everyone what he was going through. And the world, I literally mean the world, was so much behind this man because of what he had been going through, with cancer and all kinds of stuff. And then when it flipped over, when it was shown to have been a lie, the anger was just phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. And I thought, I wonder how he thinks about this and if he deeply regrets that he didn't tell the truth.
Well, and I think that you raise an outstanding point. And in fact, actually, interestingly, when I first started writing the book, this is a little-known fact, I had an entire section dedicated to him and the Live Strong brand that I ended up having to edit it out because it turns out it was a farce, right? Mm-hmm. More of him than actually, I mean, there are people that are associated with Live Strong that really are trying to make a difference in, you know, cancer and such. But the point being that he had built an entire narrative about it that we all bought into. So that's how strong it was. You know, a beautiful story about, you know, a guy that's working hard, going through all these challenges, winning on behalf of our country, representing us in a sport that a lot of people didn't even really participate in, but became very excited about because of his success. And he had so many opportunities be straight with us that he chose not to do. His brand as a person, and even all the good that he did on the things like Livestrong, is really irreparably harmed, quite frankly, because of not coming clean early on. But his story is the perfect example of how to build that narrative, but how quickly it will collapse if it's turned out to be false, which is why, as I said, the easiest thing to build is one that's true and to continually build on it, and people will connect with it both at an emotional level and just an intellectual level.
Very much so. Very, very much so. I think the most effective communicators, and I'm not talking about the hucksters, I'm talking about the people that are really most effective, are the ones that have the warts, the bruises, the scars, the calluses. And they stand in front of you and just say, this is what happened. This is not a piece of cake or whatever it is, saying this makes a difference. It is so vitally important. And you bring out a point in your book that I think is very, very interesting, that statistics don't convince people, because down deep I think people know statistics can be manipulated. You say specifically, emotionally compelling narratives do. Look at Harry Potter. Look at that story. Look at all of the narrative that's in that essence of story. And you look at The Hobbit. You look at so many different successful movies. It's all about storytelling. It's about, this is what I've experienced here. Let me show you what you can do, or something to that effect, or believe in a dream. There's so much here, but people want to relate to others that they see that are really, in their mind's perception, better than they are. It gives them hope.
Well, you know, I got to say, you really hit a lot of nails on the head there. And the way I think about it is, kindergarten teachers, or if you go back to the Berenstain Bears, we teach our kids through stories. So why do we stop at a certain point and say, well, that's 10% better than this, or that's X percent better than that, and wonder why we lose people as we go on through life in economics and statistics or astronomy or all these things? We start a certain way, and for thousands of years through oral tradition, we've gone through in a narrative way, And it's always emotional, the emotional relationship you have with somebody. When you have a kid, when you teach them, you personalize it. I understand why you may have done that, or this is why such a thing hurts when you do X, Y, or Z. But then for some reason, once they're done learning, and you're never done learning, but we, as people get older, we move on, we think that it's time to communicate exclusively with very impersonal, cold, hard facts. So it doesn't mean you get rid of it. It doesn't mean things don't have to be true. It's just in the presentation of it, people need to relate to it on an emotional level, not just this intellectual level. And how you do that is very important. And I think that this is why, even in medicine, when some difficult diagnoses are presented, I think that, we could present it that way so people can understand in a certain way. In public policy, very complex public policy things are explained by very impersonal elected officials that will just present the facts, which, as I mentioned, really may just be convenient to their own individual viewpoint. But when you think, and even in business as well, and those that have succeeded are those that tell a story about why the customer, the end user, the friend, the family member should be vested emotionally in that company, that elected official, that public policy, et cetera, just like what you would do when you're teaching your kids.
That seems to be so simple, but it just, it gets lost. Why is it in today's world, and I think it's great that this is happening, by the way, I think the transparency, that word has almost been abused ad nauseum by politicians, but I really think, I really, really think that it's so healthy when unhealthy things come to the forefront, so that you have a chance to do something about it. We have a situation, for example, in the United States. People, we've outsourced so many jobs, and I strongly believe in the spirit of the American. I think that we are so unique on this planet. We come from every corner of this globe. We have all kinds of backgrounds, and I just think that that has a magic in it because it inspires innovation, and it angers me when people say, oh, this is the only way to do something. No, there's more than one way. You might have to keep asking questions for a long time. But this seems to be a catalyst that we need to utilize more. And instead of talking down about what isn't working, why not look at what we can do to make a shift so something can start to work? And you talk in here about the message of businesses, the messages of corporations. And let's face it, without business, we're all going to be barefoot starving and be in situations like many of the third world countries that we're sending food out to every day because we have been so blessed because of the hardworking people in this country that have been willing to do what's necessary. And it takes all of us. How can the business person today, or even the gal that's running a PTA, a library, what do they need to know about putting together substance and message that's going to make a difference?
Well, the fundamental component of it is the underlying emotional narrative. So you'll hear people say, you just need to create a quick message, which they maybe even equate to a simple tagline, right, of a business. But that's it's just not that simple. So for your listeners, think about a business that you like, and it could be your local independent bookstore, it could be, for that matter, it could be Starbucks or an Apple product or Southwest Airlines, for example. These are all individual examples within the book. And what is it about? Why do you keep going back to these individual businesses? And what they've done is they built this underpinning narrative and emotional connection that isn't false, by the way. So Southwest Airlines, for example, which is an airline, you know, here in the West, we fly almost exclusively, mainly because of a lot of reasons. But they said, look, there's all these legacy carriers, they're charging you for bag. How do you justify charging somebody for a bag? I mean, that's what you need on an airline. It's just so absurd. And a lot of people are ticked off about it, right? I mean, it just seems like one of those last straw kind of things. You took away the meals, you took away the legroom, you took away the customer service. Are you going to charge me for a bag? Well, this is an airline that's been built on saying, let's just do things differently. We know people are frustrated with the way that the legacy carriers do it. That's an emotional response, people's frustration. So let's provide them with an airline that's different. So that's their narrative. Everything that they do is, we are not like the other guys. When you come on board, the way you book your tickets, the way you don't pay for the fees, everything they do, right? And so the message that they developed is based on that. Things, something like a grab your bag, it's on, right? Well, your bag is free, it's on. Back in the days when travel was fun, they're trying to message the fact that travel can be fun again. It doesn't just have to be a cattle class experience. It doesn't mean it's luxury, but it doesn't mean it's like the old days of Pan Am's Constellations, but it does mean that it's a different airline, it's a fun airline, and we're bringing back that component. So as an individual, you too have to tap into why it is that you decided to start your business or start your nonprofit or volunteer at the PTA. You have an emotional reason for that. If you're a mom who's got a million other things to do, and God bless the work that they do, and then you're also volunteering at your kid's school on the, you know, the evenings and weekends, why? Well, the reason, I'm sure, is you have an emotionally vested reason, and you want your kid, not just your kid, but your kid's friends to succeed, right? And that story is the underpinning for why you're doing it. That should be the story that everything is based on when the PTA is trying to recruit new people, and the PTA is trying to do fundraisers, and the PTA is trying to reach out to the local media. It has to be based on the underpinning reason. And what's great about it is, well, that's why you're doing it. So you should tap into why you're doing it.
I think that your book has so many good basic points of information that, as far as I'm concerned, are classic. They could be in effect, you know, 2,000 years from now. It's people are your business. People are your business. Four words that are very significant, and it doesn't seem to be taught in business school. Why?
Well, I think that and this is a great question of why do we think that everything that is a fundamental means that it has to be a number, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentals, we need to get back to teaching fundamentals. Well, that's not inaccurate. My argument, though, is that in, say, the business world, the reason for those numbers are the people behind them. The fact, I mean, a company doesn't exist unless it has a loyal customer base. And in fact, no amount of BS advertising, right, and marketing spin and glitz can buy your way out of word of mouth where people think that you're a fraud. So you really need to rely on building up these individual networks anyway of loyalty, in the way that people become loyal as they trust you. I mean, that's what a brand is. It's a promise. It's a trust. It's a connection with that product or the individual, the CEO, whatever it may be. And for some reason, though, when you look at business, finance, economics, programs, you will rarely see this component of, you'll see accounting, you'll see statistics, you'll see balance sheets, you'll see, you know, profit and loss type ledger teachings. You will rarely see anything where it says, hey, how do you actually connect with the people that are those numbers? Because guess what? You're gonna have a lot more loss than profit if you don't care about the people that are the end user and you don't connect to them in some way. And for that matter, you should be able to do it easily, because the reason that you work at that company, the reason the company was founded, is for a specific reason. You believe in it, and that story is the same story by why you want the customer to believe in it. But I think that that's a huge loss within the educational world, that we start teaching our kids, we start in kindergarten, we do all the storytelling, we teach very complex subjects through this emotional connection, and it just gets lost as time goes on, and we've become very kind of automated in the way that we approach it. You don't have to throw those things away as far as numbers go. You just have to remember that what's underpinning those numbers is a very important thing to build on.
You've brought up through your book on message a number of very, very successful businesses, various personalities that have achieved national and international recognition. And I chuckled when I saw the segment on Coors Beer, because I remember hearing about this years ago and how the employees turned a company around. And it was just so amazing. Tell us what happened with them, because all of these big, big companies and people have gone through various failures, but talk about Coors Beer, because that was quite an interesting story in your book.
Well, in the book, I tell the story about Coors. If you're sitting around saying, I've got an unbelievable distribution network, I have access to almost every retail outlet in a primary spot in the United States, I've got access to a significant supply of something that I need at a relatively low cost. I mean, you would assume, well, those are all the ingredients under statistics, economics, finance, et cetera, of making a successful business. And so Coors thought, hey, we make beer. What the initial ingredient of beer is water. And so what we're going to do is we're going to make a Coors brand bottled water. Well, they thought that they've got this in the bag. The problem was that Coors had spent their entire existence building up a narrative about being a beer company, not a water company, a beer company. They do talk about the purity of their water and those kinds of things, but fundamentally, you associate Coors with something that you don't want to be drinking on the sidelines of a soccer game if you're the soccer player. Maybe you do if you're in the audience, but not if you're the soccer player. But that's exactly what they were trying to do. It had a very similar logo, the Coors Press, all those kinds of things. And they tried to sell their water and it completely tanked. And it makes sense. I mean, can you imagine your kid going up to the freezer and grabbing a Coors, but it turns out the Coors is actually bottled water and not a beer? It doesn't play into the story mm-hmm. that they've built up about themselves. It made absolutely no sense. But what's interesting about them is that they recognized it pretty quickly. They were able to scrap, the water part of their business and go back to their fundamentals. And if you look at their advertising now, it plays back on what they are. They're first and foremost an American beer company that is not just based in America, but everything that they do plays into the American spirit and the Rockies and all these kinds of things. They are the embodiment of American beer. Budweiser tries to do a similar thing with their messaging as well, but they've gone back to that fundamental of why it is that you believe that Coors is a good product, and that's what they're doing. But they completely failed at what they should have succeeded at, right? I mean, it makes sense on at the business level. It makes sense to say that everything about them would make them succeed as a bottled water company, and they failed miserably because it just didn't play into what they had spent years building about themselves.
You have a comment in your book. You teach similarly to how you learn. And you recommend people start thinking like a kindergarten teacher. I chuckled at that. Why is that a statement in your book?
Well, you tend to teach the way that you learn, but unfortunately, you should teach people the way that they learn, because in many respects, it doesn't matter how it is you learn. You're trying to reach the end user. And the one thing that kindergarten teachers, this is at the beginning of the formation of people's minds from a school-based standpoint, preschool and kindergarten. And I went into my niece's class when I went to pick her up when I was home from school early enough, when I came home from college quite some years back. And I watched as her class was just captivated as the teacher read from Miss Nelson is Missing, this classic children's book. And it's another great book about, it's got morals and these kinds of things. And it was a hot day. This is San Diego. This is, summertime, basically. And, it doesn't matter that it's 85 degrees, and kids would normally be squirming all over the place. They're sitting there captivated. And I thought about, this teacher is reaching all of those kids with all their different learning styles, because she's doing it through images, which are the drawings on the book. She's doing it through the way that she presents it nonverbally, meaning the way that she has intonation in her voice, etc., and she's doing it through a story. And so that teaching method, all those components, using images, using voice inflections, and also the story-based component, meant that she could reach a much broader group of people in the way that she teaches. So fast forward to your last business presentation when you sat with some guy at the front giving you charts that are profit and loss numbers and talking about percentages and some death by PowerPoint. None of those things are being used in any sort of way to really convey anything that allows you to connect with it. And I've never seen a very captivated audience during most business presentations like I did those six-year-olds. And so I believe that, and there's a significant amount of neuroscience work, it turns out, about exactly this, that if you can work and teach in that same way that those kindergarten teachers are doing into more complex subjects that we deal with as adults, you would actually be able to resonate in a much better and more powerful way. And those that have succeeded, from the Apples to the Southwest to the elected officials that, like, say, Ronald Reagan, I mean, that's exactly what they've done or did. And they've, you know, history is looking favorably upon people for those reasons.
You have a substantial chapter on social media, and that can be something that's a winning proposition. It also can be something that can be just big time down the pipe lost. How can one use social media effectively? Now, we all know we don't put anything up there that we don't want the world to see. But if you're wanting to use it in a business context, what would you recommend people research and investigate? How can it be used as a working tool in the right way?
Well, one of the things that I think that people should recognize about social media, or two things I think they should recognize. One is a lot of crud out there about it. I mean, there's just a lot of people talking about, you know, posting a tweet about the fact that they're at the grocery store. And for any of your listeners that are doing that, I assure you that nobody cares that you did do that. But I will say that the other component about it that's very important is that this is where the transparency and honesty comes in. You're going to get exposed. I mean, that there are so many journalists, so to speak, since everybody's now, in essence, a home journalist, that it's a heck of a lot easier to just live in a world of truth and honesty than to have it exposed through all these other means. These aren't the days of the three broadcast networks. But those days are long gone, and so you can expect over the 24-hour, 365 news cycle that your underpinning narrative should be something that's honest. So for you to succeed on it, one of the best things that's interesting about it is that I found that those that succeed the most on social media are those that would succeed the most off of social media, people that are credible, that share personal information and personal contact. And the reason being is that with all of the stuff that people post, the things that people still resonate with are the things that are very personal that people provide, or the things that are very emotional that people provide. Sir Thomas Gresham had a theory about a couple hundred years ago regarding money, and it has since been applied to information, or at least I make an argument that it can be applied to information, which is, at the time, is bad money drives out good money, or if you have an inflationary sort of cycle, if you were to use money that's fake, meaning money that at the time is the gold standard, and so you put in things that are maybe made of something that isn't gold, that it kind of drives out good money. And I think in as far as information, you could make an argument in the same way, where as we're sort of flooded from information from social networks, can large amounts of low-quality information push out the higher-quality information. And I would say that actually would be possible unless what you're doing is very personal and emotional, what you're doing is helping people infer with what you're doing, meaning that the information that you provide leads them to their own conclusion as opposed to you providing the conclusion for them. And then there are very sort of methodical ways that you can do it as well. But the great thing about social media and local blogs and such is that if you're in a local business and you can't get the local newspaper to cover you, you might be able to find a local influential blog or a friend of yours that's a local influential, you know, person that posts a lot of, hey, I've got a personal connection with this business and they did X, Y, and Z. That'll actually, and the term is trade up the chain to a more traditional media outlet where they cover these things, they follow those things, and they don't want to get burned by their social media world. And so you may not get the local paper to cover you when you send your press release, but if you work with some of these local social media outlets that are influential, they'll end up covering the coverage and you'll end up getting it all the same. But the way that you push it out is through that personal contact, through the sets of personal information. That's a lot better than letting people know that you're at the grocery store buying a half pound of chicken on sale at Safeway.
Well, Zach, friend, this has been delightful. I know we're out of time. Now, your website is ZachFriend.com. You work with businesses, individuals. This is something that you really have a passion for. It's the world of communication, and it's a fascinating aspect of it that you bring many sides out to view in your book on message. Compelling narrative? Well, it has a great deal to do with the success for you as an individual and or your business, for those of you listening. Check out ZachFriend.com. Zach, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on the show.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away. We've got some good things to share with you, too. We'll be right back.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Hello, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number to call in to? Yes, those phone lines are open if you'd like to chat with me today. 888-627-6008. I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Tomorrow we're going to have a guest, Rhonna Prince, Sacred Journey of the Heart. This is a movie, and it is so well done. And Rhonna's story is just amazing, and I know you're just going to enjoy her tremendously. Also coming up on the show, do we have fun topics here. The mysterious origins of the hybrid man. Do you think you're a hybrid? Who knows? I've always called myself a Heinz 57. I've got so many different ethnicities or whatever that's in my family tree. One day I'm going to have it done, and I'll find out about some of those strange characters that so-and-so was involved with. Zenpreneur John Murphy is going to be my guest. Also, secret song, sounds, and ultimate healing. Now, this is all about sound healing therapy. It works. You're dealing with vibrational frequencies that is not woo-woo. It can make a difference. We're going to be talking with Sherry Edwards and Jill Mattson next week. Sherry is an incredibly and very uniquely talented woman. We're going to be finding out her personal story. And Jim Harold is coming back. Ghost Stories number 2. Jim was on my show a couple of years ago, and oh, he is fascinating. And then for those of you that are out there looking for jobs, we're going to have some help for you. Damian Burkell, the job search list. Boy, has he nailed down some good specifics. All of that and more you're going to be able to hear on The Donna Sebo Show, and I'm so delighted that you're joining me at my broadcasting table. I wanted to share something with you. This is a fun story, at least maybe that's the wrong word to use. It's not fun, it's spooky, and I love spooky stories. But we're going to step back in time a little bit. We're going to be going back to the 1100s. This is 1150, and there's a lady by the name of Mabella Tichborne. Now, this was a woman that was deeply, deeply loved. She was very wealthy. It was the end of her life. She was dying in her room at the Tichborne Manor in England. Now, it was a slow process. In fact, she was so weak, she couldn't even sit by the window in her bedroom to overlook the magnificent property that she owned. Now, her husband, whose name was Sir Roger David Tichborne, she told him, in the presence of others, her dying wish. And this is what it was. Again, think about the 1100s, that time frame. It was that a loaf of bread be given to all the poor once a year on Lady Day. It was a feast day for the Virgin Mary. Well, Sir Roger was not a very nice man, and he was very, very greedy. He had absolutely no concerns about the hungry or the poor, as his wife did. And as soon as she said that to him, he figured out a way that he was not going to be doing that at all. This is what he told his wife, however. He said, "I will distribute an annual gift in your name equal to the amount of land that she could walk upon holding a lighted torch." Now think about that. He would distribute an annual gift in her name equal to the amount of land she could walk upon holding a lighted torch. Now, this woman is very, very sick. He figured she couldn't get out of bed. Sir Roger was certain he had settled it. Nothing would be accomplished. But there was a surprise in store for Sir Roger. His wife, Lady Mabella, crawled out of bed, took the torch, and dragged her body around 23 acres of their estate. This was witnessed by so many people. To this day, apparently, this parcel of land is known as the Crawls. Now, when she finally, and it had to take her a long time, when she finally got back in her bed, she gathered the entire household around her, and she uttered a tick-borne curse. This is what she said. If the yearly dole of bread was ever stopped, the tick-borne family would die out. So began the story. She passed away. Now, the giving of bread that she had requested was done for 600 years. 600 years. However, there were local politicians, the government officials. They said, "This is ridiculous." He said, "We have all this riffraff that shows up for this dole." And they shut everything down in 1794. Ah, but the curse was very much alive. Afterwards, the male tick-borne heirs began to die. Now, there was an Edward Doherty. He was a tick-borne ancestor who had changed his name. He said he believed that the curse was in action when four of his brothers died without children. His six-year-old son suddenly died. He, Edward Doherty, was the last remaining tick-borne heir. He reinstated the giving out of a loaf of bread, which is still handed out even to this day. What do you think of that story? It just shows you, don't tick off a lady, period. Now in her heart and her spirit says, this is what's going to be done. You just don't know how it's going to happen. But that's the way life is. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. I wanted to share some fun places to visit. Weird museums. Are you a museum person? I love museums. I think they are amazing places to visit. Whether it's a Ripley's Believe It or Not museum, or it's something that has to do with farm history or Civil War, I don't care. History of a community. There's these wonderful stories that are always in museums. And I came across some information about five that are considered a little weird. One is the National Mustard Museum. And in this museum, they have on display 5,500 different mustard flavors gathered from every state and more than 70 countries. Now, how did this museum, this mustard museum, ever come into play? Well, there was a gentleman by the name of Barry Levinson. He had been involved with mustard jars. And he said, "I've just got this huge collection of mustard jars." How many of you are collectors? What do you collect? Your favorite type of dog? Crystal? Silver? matchbooks. What do you collect? Well, he started with mustard jars. And he had jars that dated back to, all kinds of times. And you know what? If you're ever visiting Wisconsin, go ahead and check out the Mustard Museum. They have so many different displays of containers of mustard, powdered mustard, which women used to have in their household pantries for a long time. And there's just so many fascinating places to see. And I know just one that would absolutely be tantalizing to you is the Toilet Seat Art Museum. Aha, you didn't expect that one, did you? Well, there's a Smith household in San Antonio, Texas. The husband, his name was Barney. She one day said, "Have you lost your marbles?" He said, "No, I've got them on a toilet seat." And what he's done, I mean, this man has really had fun doing this. And people pay to go see this. He has 1,082 works of toilet seat art hanging in his garage museum. Ah, yes, talk about recycling. Yes, we're getting down to some basics. Now, he is 92 years old. He opened up this public museum 21 years ago, and he himself, he's a retired master plumber, and he said he's using mostly items that have been, he makes them into art. That's right. He's immortalized everything, they said, from Mount St. Helens. That would be interesting. To John F. Kennedy. Okay, all right. Don't say that things are impossible. This gentleman shows you anything goes. But it just is, again, amazing what we as human beings can come up with and what we can do and how we make choices about our interests, what we want to do, what we are curious about, what makes things work. I think it's marvelous. I really do. I think it's so much fun to be able to be out there and to say, what if, or I wonder what I could do with this. Can I improve it? Let me experiment. I do that with cooking all the time. But there are so many other venues that this works with. There was a professor at MIT years ago that found that his students really were not coming up to par. They were just going by the book. Well, he got frustrated because he felt like they really weren't dipping inside themselves, number one, creatively, and number two, they were just memorizing things. They really weren't putting together why certain factors worked and others didn't. So he designed a competition. Well, the students, when the first one was going to be done, were all excited, and everybody wanted to be in the competition. And it was his classroom, per se. And by golly, he had all this junk. He gave them boxes of junk. Screws, bolts, plastic pieces. I mean, you'd look at it, and if I looked at it, I'd go, are you nuts? Who's going to make something out of this? And he told the students. He said, you're going to form teams, and you're going to be putting all of this together, and you have to design something mechanically. I don't remember whether the first one was a robot or something else. Anyway, he said, go to it. And this is the contest. It's going to be on such and such a day, and it'll be in front of everybody. Well, when he did this, little did he realize that today they're doing the same thing, and the designs and the developments that are coming out of these students are just absolutely amazing. But what happened with this is that students found a lot of the things that were in the books of engineering didn't work. When they tried to apply it in, quote-unquote, a logical way, as they had been taught, it did not work. So the students would fail, they succeeded. But more than that, they learned something else. They learned how to work together with each other as a team. And it was an incredible success. They had such a good time. The students at the college, other students that weren't involved in this particular competition, loved it. They loved seeing the resourcefulness, and it spurred a love of what can we do with a pile of junk, thinking that, again, is going on today. And I think that's something we can all really really enjoy. So don't be afraid to take on something new. Those students at MIT didn't. The guy that's got the toilet seat museum, the mustard jar museum. Who knew? Who would have thought anybody would have been interesting? We've got a caller. We're going to be taking a break. When we come back, I'll be taking the caller. And if you want to call 888-627-6008, you can call in too. This is Donna. We'll take a break for just a moment.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. We've got a very patient caller who's been waiting. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show.
How are you this morning?
I am wonderful this morning. Your first name or initial, and where are you calling in from?
Brian from San Juan Capistrano, California.
Hi, Brian. Welcome to the show. Brian, the first thing that I'm looking at is it's important for you to get certain documents into order. Now, what I'm looking at some papers that seem to be old, and I'm wondering if maybe there is a bit of history here, or if there is something that you need to find out about, like maybe genealogy in the family. But these are old papers. It looks like they've been filed away for quite a long time. And I think they were just put away. And you may need somebody to sit with you and, you know, have a bunch of cookies or fried chicken or whatever you want and something to drink and just make it a project and give yourself a day with it. I think you're going to be pleased with some of the things that you're going to find. But I do think that whenever you're going through these documents, you need to have an extra set of file folders that can be labeled so that you know specifically if there are certain documents, where they are. So the person that would work with you on this, if they could, if they've got good handwriting, or if you can do up labels in a computer and print them out so they're really legible, but you want to be able to know exactly how and where things are filed, because it's going to make a great deal of difference. And I am seeing what I will describe as a research project. And in this research, you're going through materials. I'm hearing you on the phone talking to some individuals. They're going to say, well, I don't have this, but I have something else you might be interested in. And I'm looking at you compiling quite a bit of material. So I don't know if you're putting together a book. I don't know exactly what you're doing. But what I am watching here, I'm getting the term a dossier. And I really think that you're going to need some help with this. And yes, a computer software system that suits your needs would be very appropriate. But again, it's a filing system that is so important to implement with specific designations. And then I'm seeing like compartmentalizations, and I'm looking at some boxes, and I'm looking at, they're like plastic boxes that you see at the various box stores, and you say, all right, this box is going to have blah, blah, blah. This box is going to have this. This is going to have the other. And you're going to need to work with someone. And I'll tell you something that I would encourage you to consider. If you have a local college in your environment, because this is a pretty big project, if there were some students that wanted to work as an intern that to help you do this, this might be a quicker way to go. You could instruct them on how you wanted it done. They might even have some very good suggestions for you, but by the time you get it finished, it could take up to 2 months, maybe 3 months, to get this all done. Once it's in order, then there's going to be what I feel a very carefully thought out process of how you are going to scan certain things, what you're going to do, and then you're going to put it together. Now, what I'm looking at are 3 volumes. And when I'm looking at these 3 volumes, I'm going, my goodness, this is a lot of detail and information. And they're going to be beautifully done. Whoever is going to help you put it together, it is something that I think will be quite an accomplishment when you're finished. I have no idea what the subject matter is at this moment, but I do think that this is going to be quite an accomplishment. Now, one of the things I want to encourage you to do, make sure that when you're working with all these papers, because there's going to be dust. That's just what happens when you work with papers and environment, especially old documents. You want to make sure that you have a well-ventilated area, and if necessary, have maybe something that is going to take the dust out of the air. Because when you start really getting involved in whatever it is that's going on here, that will help keep sneezing down. And it's like then my sinuses won't bother me because, again, it's just dust and dust mites and all that kind of stuff. You're not going to get sick off of this. It's just irritating. So be aware that you want it done in a place that's going to be fairly tidy, and vacuuming would be a good idea afterwards, and making sure once you've got everything sorted that you keep the lid on the boxes or keep them contained. So that whatever you're working with, it's just that small amount and not just this whole huge amount of papers that I'm looking at. You've got an interesting project in front of you. Very interesting, Brian. What's on your mind? What did you want to ask me this morning?
My interesting question is, do you think my nephew and I get along very well together or not?
I think you and your nephew are very different people. As far as being able to get along, I think in some respects you possibly could. It probably would be a big mistake, let's say, if the two of you tried to go into business together. It wouldn't be very harmonious because you really have very different ways of looking at things, and your communication styles are very different. If you wanted to integrate in any way with your nephew, I think it's important that you be very clear about what your priorities are. And this is something the nephew may not be particularly excited about, but that is important. That is important. But I don't see the two of you, my goodness, if you went into business together, you'd be miserable.
I agree with you.
It just isn't going to happen.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Brian. Thank you for your call.
I'll call back again some other time. Bye-bye.
All right, sir. Thank you. I appreciate your listening. Tell your friends. Yep. This is Donna Sebo. My goodness, the hour has just flown by, and I'm so delighted that you've joined me at my broadcasting table. And I invite you to join me tomorrow because I know we're going to have more good things to share with you. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. I want you to know that it's so important to keep your mind open for learning. Be aware that this world has so many aspects of experience to it. And if you think you're bored, gee whiz, check out a group, an organization. Reach out for life, because life is you in action. And when you're in action, you're going to get things done. And sometimes all it takes is a little shift in your thinking. That's right. This is Donna Sebo. Have a magnificent day or evening wherever you are on this glorious planet of ours. Say a prayer for the people in the Philippines and just know that if you want to contribute or donate to those organizations that really are committed to serving the well-being of others, there's millions of people that are going through a lot of suffering right now, Philippines and in so many other parts of the world. As Americans, we're known as some of the most generous people on this planet, and that is a true statement, because we come from everywhere on this planet. God bless. Talk with you tomorrow. Bye now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.